I'm Ashley.
And I'm Brooke.
And you're here with us on A Teachers Who Talk Crime
Podcast. Hey guys.
Hey, y'all.
So we have an exclusive interview for you guys today, which is something that we are so honored to be a part of. And if you are not familiar with episode 99, we covered the case of Daniel Bartlam. And if you need to go back and listen to that before this, it will all make a little bit more sense. And it will help you kind of stay focused on what we're talking about today. But we posted some social clips on TikTok and we had a DM. And that DM came from Dominic Bartlam. And we were asked by Dominic if he could speak out on our platform. And so obviously, we said yes.
We sure did.
So we have Dominic here with us today, and he is going to introduce himself and kind of explain why he's ready to speak out now and why he chose us.
Perfect. I mean, I'm Dominic. I chose to speak out because, you know, when I was six, if you know the story, my mom was killed by my brother. And for years and years and years, I had to deal with, you know, hearing different stories of different things. And I was there firsthand. I witnessed everything. And I felt now that I'm, you know, I'm old enough, I'm 19 now. I'm in a position where I can speak out, tell the truth of what happened, and also give a bit more insight into what happened afterwards. Because I feel like that, in any case, whether it's mine or anyone else's, is very, very, very important what ends up happening to the person that was involved in the crime. So I hope by speaking out, maybe it can shed some light onto what life is like afterwards and how it ends up.
Wow.
That's awesome. And we really appreciate you being here.
Yes.
I know that we have just been chatting, like, we are now best friends, guys.
Yeah,
like,
we're friends.
Literally best friends. Like, when we travel, we're going to go see Dom. But we are just really excited for you to be here, and we're going to kind of jump right into it. And we really want to start with your mom. So if you want to tell us about your mom and what her memory means to you now, that would be awesome.
Of course. I mean, my memories of my mom, I've always had very vivid in my mind because most people, you know, I was six, nearly seven when my mom passed. Most people forget about things from when they were really young, like 3, 4, 5 years old. But because of the circumstances, I feel like it's cemented in my brain. You know, I can't remember what I had to eat for lunch today, but I can remember almost every day for the 2 years leading up to it. She was kind, she was loving, you know. Yeah, I couldn't have asked for a better mom, to be honest. Like, and I'm not saying that as a point of, oh, everyone says that about their parents. Genuinely, I can't think of anyone better suited than her. You know, some of my best memories would be when she took us away to Turkey or anything like that. And I could go on and on and on about all my different memories with her. But the main thing that matters to me was she was a good parent. She was a, you know, as far as a mother goes, she was one of the best you could get.
That's an amazing award.
My mom didn't take me to Turkey.
Right?
Yeah.
We went to the beach a lot. We didn't go to Turkey. But that's about it. Yeah. And then your mom was, tell us about like her having you and Daniel and kind of like her life leading up to everything.
Yeah, of course. Like I'll kind of go back to just before I was born almost and say she met my dad in the 90s. She had Daniel midway through to the late 90s. And then they ended up actually getting married in 2000, and they were married out in Orlando. And then fast forward a few more years, 2004, they had me. And then a couple of years or a year or two later, they'd split up. So then because of my dad's schedule, you know, he has his own business. He still does now. He was a workaholic. So it meant when they did split up, it was relatively amicable. But at the same time, it meant that we spent a lot of time with my mom. So me and Daniel would spend, you know, probably every other week we'd go to my dad's, but only for one day on like a Saturday or maybe overnight on a Saturday night. So a lot of our time was spent with my mum. She also worked hard. She worked full time. She'd drop us off at school in the morning, and then she would go to work, and then our aunt would pick us up from school, and my mum would get back about 6:30. So, you know, she was there a lot, as much as, you know, a single parent could be. Mm-hmm. And she always made sure that we were always looked after. It wasn't like she would work full time and I was 5 finishing school at 3:00 and I would have to get home and I'd sit there for 3 hours waiting for her to come back. She always made sure we were looked after. But we had a relatively simple, normal life, like as normal as anybody's life is. Spent time with grandparents, spent time with other family. And yeah, when we saw my dad once every 2 weeks usually.
Okay. And then, you know, sources say that you had a male figure in your life, Simon. We talked about him in the case, so that is public knowledge, but we kind of wanted to get your take on the Simon situation.
Yeah. When my mom split up from my dad, probably a couple of years later, so when I was 4, maybe, so 2008, 2009, she started seeing Simon. And, you know, it wasn't anything majorly serious. At least he was never living with us. Mm. To be honest, I don't ever remember him spending a night with us. When we moved into the house at Red Hill, I get this story from my aunt now of why we didn't see him after we moved to Red Hill. And my aunt's exact words were, to be honest, Simon had a van and he was quite handy to be able to help to move his house. And then after that, we never saw him again. Mm. So at least a year, maybe two before my mum died, probably a year and a half, I'd say, Simon wasn't in our life. And even when he was in our life, I think I met the guy 4 times at most.
Wow.
And I always see him on documentaries, on the news, like even on the day that Daniel was sentenced. He was the first person on the news trying to give interviews, which didn't make sense because, you know, he wasn't there. And claiming to be a stepdad is the most far-fetched thing that I could ever imagine, because not only was he not there that time before, he was never, even when he was there, I'd met him maybe 4 times. Mm-hmm. He wasn't, you know, a mainstay in the house. He wasn't over every other night or anything like that. I don't even remember him spending the night while we were there.
Wow.
So for him to be able to turn around and say that he's a stepfather is, to be honest, it's complete and utter lies. I'm happy to say that. And he kind of showed his true colours when my mum passed. He came back into my life, my aunt's life. He tried to make himself a trusted figure. And when my aunt had just been through what she went through, she gave him the keys to go into the house to fix a leak. This is probably 3 weeks after my mum passed, when the scene had been released to her. And so because she was picking me up from school, she just gave him the keys and she went to go pick me up. He did fix a leak in the house, but then he'd also been upstairs and got my mum's wedding photos that were hidden somewhere upstairs. I'm not sure where. But then lo and behold, the next day in the newspaper, online, on everywhere, loads of photos of my mum's wedding. The only place it could have ever come from was him. Mm-hmm. Because only 3 people saw them photos before he did, mm-hmm. which was my mom, my dad, and my aunt. Long story short, to make it simple for why no one else ever saw them, my parents got married out in Orlando as a very small ceremony, not very many people there. So when she had the photos taken, she came back from a honeymoon. And in the meantime, another close family member had passed away, or 2 close family members had passed away in a car accident, and they were killed by a drunk driver. So when she got the photos back, it was around the same time as when that funeral was. So she never felt comfortable to be in a moment of grief to be sharing them photos with everyone to go, well, yeah, look at my wedding, look at my dress. So she never showed them to anyone. And he robbed her of the opportunity to keep that hidden in private. Not only my mum, but also my aunt who lost her son, also my cousins who lost their mother. In that car accident, he robbed all of them of the privacy that they deserve.
Yeah.
So, you know, aside from him wanting to give interviews, that it was theft. It was theft.
Yeah.
It's out of order. And there's only one reason I see him doing all these interviews, which is money. On these documentaries, close family members of mine have been offered nice sums of money to be able to go on, even people that are a lot less fortunate than some other members of my family, and they always refuse. But with him, I believe it's, you know, he thinks there's a monetary gain, so if he can go on and spit some lies out in front of the camera and give them what they want to hear, then, you know, it's happy days for him. But it's wrong. He shouldn't be able to profit off my mom's death.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And that just speaks to her character that, you know, she's so selfless. Like, she didn't want to take away from what else was happening in the family to relish in the good thing that happened in her life. And I think that speaks volumes to her character. And what you just described speaks volumes to his character, because he profited off of the loss of your mom.
Yeah, 100%. And he'll probably try and continue to do so. But a big reason of why I'm now speaking about this is, if they were to want to make another documentary, which they do every 3 years periodically, and if someone wants to make another YouTube video or podcast or anything, I hope now they will either listen to my take and disregard him, or they'll come to me first before going to him. And in no way will I ever be part of anything that he is. So hopefully that can stop the lies that he said.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we're going to kind of jump into that particular night. And I just, we want to know, what can you tell us about that night and your brother escorting you out of the house? I know we spoke about, did he carry you out? Did he take you by the hand? It's, you know, it's tit for tat. It doesn't really matter. Either way, he, you know, escorted you out of the home that night as the home was burning. And we kind of just want to get your point of view of the whole night in itself and leading up to that night, if there's anything that you feel comfortable telling us.
Yeah, of course. I'll kind of go over the few nights leading up to and the night itself, because I feel like it's all, in my brain at least, it's all as one. You know, the place that I'd start is in the week leading up. Daniel was burning paper. My mum knew this, and she told my aunt and noticed that, and, you know, obviously tried to tell him not to and tried to punish him. But anyway, he was burning paper. And I think two nights before my mum passed, and I remember the look she gave me that night. We were still at the bottom of our stairs. She held me by the arms and said, "Dom, if you hear the fire alarm, get out of the house." And when we discussed it before, I said part of me felt like she knew something was coming. But I don't think she knew that what was going to happen and that it would result in her death. But I believe that she probably thought that an accident was going to happen, or he was going to do something stupid. And she warned me. She warned other people that were obviously coming into the house or anything like that. But it's a shame that she never took it as seriously as she probably should have in the end, which ultimately resulted in her dying. But on that night, it was a relatively regular evening. Watched TV, went up to bed, and I was asleep. And then I was kind of stirring in my sleep, and I remember briefly waking up, hearing what I thought was shouting. But, you know, when I'm 6 years old and it's the early hours of the morning, I've gone straight back to sleep because, you know, it's hard to keep your eyes open.
Yeah.
And then I remember waking up at the top of the stairs in Daniel's arms. He's carried me down the stairs as I'm dozing in and out of sleep. And then as I've got to the front door, he's like put me down on my feet, and I'm awake then fully, and I'm conscious. I know what's going on. He goes and takes the family dog out into the back garden while I'm stuck there. And he walks me over with him to the neighbor's house. And the neighbors were already awake and like dressed, which was, you know, in hindsight, fairly odd. Like, why would they, in the early hours of the morning, be wearing clothes? It's almost like they knew that someone was going to come knocking on the front door. Anyway, they let us in. They sit us in their living room, which was towards the back of the house. And we sat on the sofa, me and Daniel. And I can tell that the gentleman that lived there was pacing almost back and forth. And the lady that lived there, his wife, also seemed a bit cagey, but she was more focused on making sure I was all right. But the man, he was almost circling. And now I know that he heard the argument, he heard my mum scream, and he knew, well, he didn't know that Daniel had done it, but he could take a very good guess that he did. So we sat in that front room for, you know, it could have been 5 minutes, it could have been 50, I'm not sure, to be honest, but we were sat in there, didn't say anything. And then obviously you have all the police, fire engines, ambulances, and they come in and check on me, and they decide, oh, it would be better if we take him to hospital. Not that there was anything wrong with me, but just as a precaution.
Yeah.
So they put me in the back of the ambulance, and, you know, from that moment on, I was split from Daniel. I'll go over first what happened with me, and then I'll kind of circle back to what happened with him. I go to the hospital in an ambulance. We have a young police officer that came with me and my aunt that also was in the ambulance with me. He must have only been, like, he must have only joined the police maybe a year or two ago at that point.
Wow.
So he was a young man, but he was perfect, to be honest. He was, as far as what you could ask for someone to be there at that moment, he was as good as you can get. We arrived at the hospital. It was at the QMC. And as they're going to get me out of the ambulance, there's a fight happening outside the back of the ambulance for some reason.
Oh, yeah, my gosh.
There were, some people just fight. So then the poor police officer that's had to deal with this when he's only a young lad has then had to go out and break up a fight. Eventually, I go in, go into the hospital bed, and I've fallen asleep until the next day. So that was kind of what happened with me from that. With Daniel, he's been asked by police what happened, and he's told the story of a masked intruder who fled over the fields opposite of our house. He's then been let go by police, even though the police knew it was him, but obviously they need to make sure that certain thresholds have been met of, okay, let's make sure we nail him, because if we arrest him and then something doesn't add up, we're in trouble and he goes for it.
Right.
So they've let him go. He went in the car with my granddad to his house, which wasn't that far away. So they've gone there. He sat in there with them, at which point my aunt's kind of questioned, thinking it was him as well. She thought it was him. So she sent over my two older cousins, who are essentially just keep watch to make sure, okay, my elderly parents are in there. I don't want him to do anything else. Mm-hmm. So she sent them and they watched it. And then lo and behold, probably a few hours later, the police had turned up and arrested him, and he's gone into questioning from there. So that was kind of the events of that night as such, and a couple of days leading up before.
Mm-hmm. So he never said anything to you while he was escorting you out the house? Like, he didn't say anything?
Like, to say that he didn't say anything won't be true, but, like, to say anything of meaning, he didn't. It was almost like a, okay, yeah, let's go over to the neighbors kind of thing. Like, it wasn't, oh, are you okay? It wasn't, oh, there's this, there's that. He didn't say anything at first. When we got to the neighbours, just before I went in, he told me the story of the masked intruder, which I never really believed. But, you know, he mentioned that briefly, but aside from that, he didn't really say much. Not much at all.
So you saw the fire taking place, but did you know something had, like, happened to your mom?
Like, yes and no. Like, I was worried that she, at first, I didn't know that he'd obviously hit all the hammer. That was the main issue. I thought the house had caught fire, and I didn't know if it was Daniel or it was something else, but I thought the house just caught fire. So while I was in the hospital, obviously, I've asked for my mom over and over and over. And then the next day when I've woken up, I've asked my auntie again. And that's when she's got the chaplain at the hospital to come down. Which is always, people always look at me when I say that, go, oh, it's religious. We're not religious in the family, but for some reason she's always had the chaplain come break that news, which is the right thing to do, I think, because they are the best equipped to deal with that. But anyway, he's ended up telling me in the hospital, you can't see your mom, she's passed away. And at first I didn't say anything. I didn't cry. I didn't do anything. I just sat there. And then my auntie whispered in my ear, it's okay, you can cry. And I cried. And I cried and I cried. Until I went home with her, and I stayed at her house for a couple of weeks. But yeah, at first I thought that maybe my mum was hurt in some way. I didn't necessarily realize, okay, she's going to pass away.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Ooh, that's a lot. And I mean, that does kind of beg the question because, I mean, we spoke yesterday about how people that have things like this happen to them, and maybe not even to this extent, just anything in their life, the media and society tells you you're supposed to be, you know, become a statistic. And we just kind of want to know, what is your life like now? And what's your like family life like? How did you combat all of this and what happened?
Like for my life now, it's pretty standard for a, you know, 19-year-old lad in the UK. Like it's normal, which is nice. You know, that's all I really want, is to be the same or anything like that. And in by all intents and purposes, I am now. But like family life, when my mum passed, I'll tell the story of when I ended up going to my dad's, which was a couple of weeks after my mum passed. And if my dad ever asked my auntie at any point to go, okay, Carol, we want you to hand Dom over to us. You can see him once a week or whatever, but we just want him to come live with me because I'm his dad. My auntie would have had no objections. Instead, he tricked her into going to the police station, had her taken there for what she thought was questioning with me. My cousins were there as well because they came with us. And they had, you know, police stand in front of my cousins and my auntie. And the police said to him, if you do anything to stop him from taking Dom, you'll be arrested. Where one of the police officers, as it was happening, apologized to my auntie and my cousins and said, I'm really sorry, I don't want to do it, but our hands are tied. He took me out, like he picked me up, and I was screaming and screaming because, you know, my only experiences of being at my dad's without my mum were when I was there with Daniel, where Daniel could get away with a lot more at my dad's. You know, some of the things he would, like, do there and how it made me feel there. That was my only memory of being there. So I really didn't want to go. But, you know, and instead of taking me from that police station into his house, you know, it would have been 8 o'clock in the evening, giving me like something small to eat as a snack and then going to bed, having a calm night. He instead drops me straight off at his sister's, who I love. I love that auntie anyway, but it's besides the point. Instead of, he took me away from my auntie that night, but his reasoning to her was, so I can have a relationship with my son. But if that's the case, then why didn't you drop him off at the first available opportunity? He left that night, didn't come back till the next day. And instead of then trying to comfort me, his first thought was, oh, I know what can fix this. Let's go. There's a shop called Curry's. It's now like Curry's PC World. I went in there and his first thought was, let's get him a 3DS. Because I think that had just come out at the time. And I still have, it's like the silver, oh, not silver, it's like the shiny blue DS. I had it somewhere. But that was his first response of, okay, how can I fix this? You know, my dad, in a lot of ways, wasn't a bad dad. In a lot of ways, he wasn't. And I wouldn't feel comfortable lying and saying that he mistreated me as such. He could always provide for us. You know, he had a good job. He drove nice cars. We lived in a nice house. If I needed new clothes, that wasn't an issue. But emotionally, as a parent, he was horrendous, you know, and he still is to this day. I have very limited contact with him now, just because the emotional side of him has never worked, I don't think. And part of me thinks that that's a big reason of how it got to the place where Daniel did what he did. Not to blame my dad as such, but I feel like he definitely could have helped prevent it. Daniel was almost free reign in his house, you know. Like one example is, one day he tied me up, gagged me and locked me in the room. And because my dad just wouldn't pay attention and he wasn't there for a lot of it, you know, that was what my experience was there. And Daniel probably had a bit too much give over there as opposed to having to draw it back in. It didn't help, obviously, that Daniel loved my dad a lot more than he ever loved my mom. He loved my dad, where I was the opposite. And my dad, every time he saw us, would always give some spiel of, you know, I want to see more. And there was never, my mum never stopped him from seeing us more. my dad wasn't around to see us more. Half the time, I think he was meant to have us every week, but it was more like once every 2 weeks because he'd end up going to London to work overnight and he wouldn't be back to pick us up, which he informed my mum of. It wasn't like he was abandoning us, but we were never his priority. And I don't think it was right for him to have children in all truth. But aside from that, Daniel's getting fed this spiel by my dad of, okay, I want to see you more. He loves my dad. Part of him probably blames my mum for the divorce, which is completely further from the truth. And I think that's resulted in him going almost down a rabbit hole of, okay, I hate my mum, which he had no reason to. He was always treated very, very, very well by her. But, you know, obviously he didn't feel that way, which I could never understand. But, you know, family relations afterwards, my dad ended up going for a custody battle with my aunt because my mum's side of the family still wanted to see me. And he tried to block that completely at first before they fought in court and were able to see me up until I was 18. And I obviously had free reign. They were allowed to see me once every 2 weeks on a Thursday. Exactly the same at once every 2 weeks, which, you know, was difficult because it's hard not only to lose your mom and then have to go to a place where you're not comfortable, but then to have such limited contact with the people that you are comfortable with, it's not easy. In a lot of ways, my dad failed me. Not to say that he's the world's worst parent. I know a lot of parents that have done a lot worse, and I'm grateful in a lot of ways for how my dad has been able to help me. But the emotional side of him, and I think almost the paranoia as well of I am the same blood as my brother, which I'm stuck with. Like, I would never dream of doing anything like he has. I'm not in any way similar to him. But it's very, very, very disappointing, I think, if I look back at a lot of my childhood with my dad from when I was 7 till I was 17 when I left his house. In that 10 years, all I can really remember is almost like if I did something wrong and another person that lived there, whether it be a stepsister, half-sister, did something wrong, my dad would go crazy at me, like absolutely crazy. You know, I was restricted in a lot more ways as well. Like, you know, my elder sister, when she was my age, she would have been able to go out until it was, you know, time for dinner. With me, it was once it's 3 o'clock, you're back home. I was kind of restricted. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because he was worried that what if I am the same, which I never was. But instead of when I, you know, was old enough where I could speak, instead of him listening and going, well, there's nothing wrong with him, he kind of carried on, and he carried on for a long time. But it's led to a distant relationship from my dad with my dad now. Not to say that I hate him, not to say that anything like that, but in a lot of ways, he failed before my mum died, and then he failed afterwards.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, this question isn't on the list, but I just randomly thought about it. We are a teacher podcast, and I know yesterday you spoke about a teacher who, once you returned to school, was very, like, you know, like a good person to help you through what you were doing. Would you mind, like, speaking about her?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, when I first went back into school, it was probably too soon, to be honest, but it was a couple of weeks after my mom passed. And she passed in the Easter half term. So we had 2 weeks off at Easter, and she passed at the start of the second week. So I believe I missed the first week back, but then I missed the first couple of weeks back in school, but then I was back in the next week. So it wasn't very long that I was off. But then when I first went back, I went into my class, which was year two at the time, and they had a teaching assistant for the class that was obviously new, but I wouldn't have known of until later years, where people said, no, she came to that class when you were there. And she was obviously put there for a reason, probably to help me. But, you know, I've had a lot of teachers over the years try and make me a bit of a pet project of, oh, maybe he's broken, let me see if I can fix him and get him good grades. She was very different to where she helped me. She looked out for me. She would pull me aside and make sure I was comfortable with everything. But it never felt like she was almost doing it for her own benefit. It was never, oh, well, he's not expected to do very well. Let me prove them wrong. It was more, I want to help this kid. So, yeah, her name was Miss White. And she stayed with me for a long time in school. She moved up with my year. And then, obviously, over the years, she wasn't as involved because she didn't have to be. But, no, she was with me probably 3-4 years. And she was brilliant. Yeah, no, as far as teachers go, she's probably the best one I ever had.
That's really sweet.
It is.
And I think that with like what you've said and just from like my perspective, your dad clearly lacked that nurturing aspect mm-hmm. that your mom had. In most parent dynamics, you have a strict one, you have a nurturing one. And so he lacked that nurturing, which you didn't get. And I'm glad that you found that through your aunt and your teacher and other figures in your life
yes.
that have obviously made you who you are today mm-hmm. And someone that we've genuinely enjoyed getting to know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think the next thing we kind of want to get into is, do you plan on speaking to your brother? Have you spoken to your brother? Where are your thoughts with that?
I don't plan on speaking to him. By the time I was old enough to make the decision of if I ever wanted to, and a lot of other family, especially on my mom's side, had spoken to him. And they spoke to him probably closer to the time of the incident, but he never gave them any answers. And if anything, he probably gave them more questions. And I've always said mm-hmm. when Daniel killed my mom, he didn't just kill my mom. He also killed her mom, because just over a year after, and my mom had passed, she passed, and it had such an effect on her when my mom passed that it was obvious that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And she went downhill yeah. mentally. She got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and before you know it, she also died. And the one thing she couldn't wrap her head around is when she went and visited him and asked him, he wouldn't give any kind of answer. If anything, he said things that gave her a lot more questions. So once I was old enough to make that decision of, do I want to speak to him? I thought my only questions would be why. I don't want to have a relationship with him. And I would never be convinced by him to want a relationship with him. So I won't be going for that purpose. I'd be going to get answers, which he's already proven that he won't give. And, you know, over the years, it probably took me longer than most to get out of the issues that I had from what happened, because I wasn't given counselling, I wasn't given therapy, and my dad didn't really speak to me ever about it. So I thought, if I went back once I was old enough to speak to him, am I just going to want to do all the process that, or all the progress that I made before? Like, it would be almost pointless to me. And knowing who he is from before he went away, and the things I've heard from people that have been around him in prison, he's a master manipulator. He's charismatic. You know, he could talk his way out of anything. Like most people that have killed their own moms wouldn't feel safe in a prison, but somehow he has them all convinced. You know, whether that's making up stories about abuse or anything of the sort to try and get out of it. So I don't want to let myself ever be in a position where I could ever fall for any of his lies. You know, I had to deal with them for a long time growing up. I had to deal with the outcome of what it eventually led to. I don't want to have to deal with modern day lies of this. So yeah, I don't have a plan on seeing it. And you know, if and when he comes out of prison, I've always said he'll only ever knock on my door once. Now I'll tell him not to come find me ever again. And then past that, it's a different issue of, I will make sure that he goes back into jail for the rest of his life. But aside from that, I'll give him one opportunity to knock on my door where he will be told to never try and find me again, which when he comes out, there will be restrictions on if he can reach out to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as there should be.
Yeah.
And he's never tried to reach out to you since you've been?
No, so he's stayed in constant contact with my dad, which I've always, part of me has always resented my dad.
Wow.
You know, my dad will probably visit him once a month, minimum once every 2 weeks, more likely. He's got through prison, through you know, he's always been in lower security prisons because he was young. And then when he went up into prison, he'd been in for a while on good behavior. So he wasn't in a hellhole somewhere. He could have a TV. He could have a radio. He'd just have to buy it. And then when my dad whips out his checkbook and pays for everything for him, it's always made me feel, almost resent my dad a lot of ways for that. And it's easy for me to say that he shouldn't have a relationship with him. But at the same time, it is his son. You know, I can understand wanting to have some form of contact with him. I always felt that there's contact to making sure that he's still alive. And then there's contact of speaking to him once every 2 weeks, paying for everything. You know, if Daniel ever wanted a new pair of trainers in prison, all he'd have to do is say the word and my dad would pay for it. So, yeah, I've always resented my dad a little bit for that.
Yeah. So your dad's solution to things has always been the mindset of throw money at it and it gets better.
Yeah, 100%. No matter what it was always, I can buy my way out of this hole. Part of me feels that's because of where he was when he was younger. He grew up in an area that was, you know, by all intents and purposes, a poor area. His dad, you know, didn't make very much. His mom, up until she died not too long ago, she worked until she was 86 behind a bar. You know, they didn't drive a car. They lived in a very small terraced house. So when he had money of his own, I think that felt his way out of, you know, he can buy his way out of everything from then on, which has never worked, unfortunately. It gets him in more trouble. He gets more issues.
Right.
Yeah. So we spoke yesterday and you told us that there were some discrepancies with some of the things that have come out that Daniel had not gotten any help for his supposed mental issues. And I know that you said that that was far from the truth. So would you like to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I've watched a lot of things when they've come out about Daniel or about anything, because especially once I was old enough, it was always good for me to see the things that were said before I had someone come up to me in school and say them. And so I knew what I was going into and I knew what the truth was and how to respond. A lot of the productions, whether it be a podcast on YouTube or even on TV, a lot of them have always said he never got the help that he needed. You know, my mum, some of them go as far as saying my mum refused him the help that he needed, which couldn't be further from the truth. You know, he been sent to go see the school counsellor at request of my mum multiple times. And then the most notable one of, okay, a fully-fledged therapist, a fully-fledged one, she took him to CAMHS, which is in the UK, if you're not from here, it's a mental health organisation ran by the government for young people, essentially, whether it be children or young adults. So she took him to CAMHS, where they went to essentially... They went for a consultation almost of, let's see what's wrong with it. Daniel went into the room by himself. He wasn't coerced. And as he came out of the room, the counsellor that spoke to him said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with him. They couldn't find anything wrong with him. And even in court, he stood by that assessment, that there was absolutely nothing wrong with him. And as they were walking out, he also, in court, said that, he saw my mum hugging Daniel to say, look, there's nothing wrong with you. But she did take him to get the help that he needed. A lot of people in a lot of the productions that have said that my mum was hesitant, which is true to some degree. And I think that if you are a parent in any way, if I had a child and, you know, I was worried, I would be slightly hesitant to go reach out for that help because, you know, whether it be embarrassment, whether it be worried that you've done something wrong as a parent, it's very difficult for people to be able, or it's very easy for people to be able to say, oh, take them back the day off. You know, as a parent, you've got to think about everything. And although she was maybe worried about doing it, she did it relatively quickly. So he had every piece of support he could ever need. He wasn't held back from anything. So when I see in certain productions it's saying, oh, well, he was refused help, it's categorically untrue. and I've witnessed him getting help.
Wow. So do you think that, in your opinion, we are not doctors, obviously Dominic's not a doctor either, but being there firsthand, do you think that his manipulation is kind of what swayed these therapists and counselors? Or do you think he has a, you know, do you think your brother could be a psychopath?
I think he's a psychopath. Okay. Like I would, yeah, almost 100% in my eyes, do I see him as a psychopath? Mm-hmm. I feel like he's, the issue was with Daniel, if he was anyone else, he wouldn't have ever been able to get as far as he did, and he would have been caught for 1,000 other things before what happened. The issue was, as much as I hate to admit it, he is incredibly intelligent. And I hate to admit it. You know, he's smarter than I am. I'll admit that. And I feel like the issue is when you throw that into a mixer with, okay, him being a psychopath, all of a sudden you get out this smoothie of, okay, I'm going to do what I want, but I can convince everyone that everything I do is, you know, God's word almost. Like, he was very theatrical, but also very manipulative in a degree where it was intelligence, you know. When I was speaking to you about it yesterday, I mentioned that, you know, a lot of people up in high places, whether it be CEOs, a lot of them are psychopaths. There's a difference between a psychopath that kills and a psychopath that just sees the world differently. It's how you're wired up. With him, unfortunately, it was a state of a psychopath that decided to kill and thought he was smart enough to get away with it. And I think if he was a little bit older, he would have stood a better chance, in all truth. You know, not to say that he would have got away with it, but, you know, he was still naive about certain things. But as far as actual straight-up intelligence goes, he's smarter than I'll ever be. And I feel like that was the issue. Oh, he could go into these appointments, but because he was first off wired up to be in a certain mindset of a psychopath, and also the intelligence to be able to talk his way out of anything, it was a deadly combination. As opposed to if you had a psychopath that wasn't smart enough to get out of situations, they'd click on like that. If you had someone that was highly intelligent and not a psychopath, they wouldn't be the therapists in the first place. So it's...
Right.
You know, he had a deadly combination of it, which is unfortunate.
Well, I think you speak to like his intelligence too, knowing that it was premeditated. It wasn't a random act. And I mean, we discussed that in the podcast and you talked about it yesterday, just the amount of things that were premeditated speaks to his intelligence as a 14-year-old.
Yeah, 100%. You know, he thought out everything miles in advance. Obviously not far enough, you know.
Correct.
His big downfall was that the big piece of evidence was obviously the story that he wrote. And for someone that claimed to be so technically proficient, he didn't realize that it's very hard to fully wipe a hard drive and not leave a trace for forensics. Almost impossible. So he clearly wasn't smart enough. But, you know, he was convinced he would get away with it. And then I think when it set into him a few months after it happened, that he wasn't going to get away with it, all of a sudden he was convinced that he could get it down to manslaughter. Which is when they eventually went to court, it was not an argument of, well, at least for the jury, it wasn't ever going to be an argument of guilty or not guilty. It was, what is he guilty of, you know? And that's what his solicitors / lawyers were, or barristers even, were trying to get it down to. They were trying to get it to a manslaughter charge, because at his age, after a manslaughter charge, he probably could have been out on parole and 3-4 years, slap on the wrist.
Wow.
I think if he wasn't caught with the story and he deleted that properly and they couldn't prove that he had planned it, I think he would have got a manslaughter charge, because he was very theatrical in front of a jury and tried to convince them there was 1,001 reasons why he hated my mom, all of which were refuted by everybody else that knew her. But he made a good argument of, oh, well, she XYZ. So I think he maybe could have got it down to a manslaughter charge if it wasn't so premeditated. like it, as far as well, you guys have your first degree murder, as far as first degree murder goes, I think it's mm-hmm. the most open and shut first degree murder you could ever have. You know, if mm-hmm. someone writes exactly what they've done right. before they've done it, I mean, you can't be more premeditated, unfortunately. Yeah. You can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we speak about this on our podcast. We are very unfamiliar with other judicial systems. There is no age limit that can be subpoenaed. Now here, I was subpoenaed in third grade, but obviously I did not go because my parents have the right as a minor to mm-hmm. say no to that. Were you ever asked to testify or give statements even though you were so young?
Not in court.
Okay.
But I believe they wouldn't have used what I said anyway, because when I was interviewed by police, I hadn't seen Daniel kill my mum. And the only thing I had to say to police was, I never said that it was a masked intruder, which, you know, I never said that. However, I said, Daniel said it was a masked intruder. That's all I ever said, because that's all I saw firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said to me, don't guess, don't like make something up. Just tell us what you saw that night. And I said, well, I didn't see anything. I only saw Daniel, and he said it was a masked intruder. So they wouldn't have used anything I said, but they did interview me. They interviewed me.
Okay.
They tried interviewing me for probably like half an hour. I was sat in the room and almost asking the same question, because I think the person that was interviewing me probably failed to realize, yeah, I wasn't lying to cover him. You know, I never lied. I told the truth the whole time. I think he maybe thought that I knew something more, which I didn't know firsthand.
Right.
Something more at the time. You know, I could speak to how Daniel was beforehand, but they never asked me. They only ever asked me what happened that night. So they asked me the same question as many times as they physically could, and then realized, yeah, maybe he just doesn't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a question.
And it's crazy because they have people over here that specifically, like when there's a child involved, they're the ones to interview. And it seems like in your situation, that was not awarded to you. And I wonder if it's because of the difference in judicial systems or like...
Well, if I remember rightly, though, I feel like there was a social worker also there. Mm. Okay. But as far as social workers go, she didn't really say much, let's put it that way.
Mm.
And, you know, social workers were a part of my life in some way for the next year or so afterwards. And they probably should have been a lot more involved in my life. They were almost pushed away by my dad. And it's in the same way I was offered free counselling and therapy. And my dad refused it, saying he was going to pay for me to have it privately. He never paid for me to have it privately, which is even more difficult because I couldn't speak to my dad about it. But yeah, I mean, I've always said if my dad wasn't, I've never said that my dad's rich, but if he wasn't as well off as he was, where he could afford to have two cars on the driveway, live in a decent sized house with a nice garden, and go out and eat in a restaurant twice, three times a week,
mm-hmm.
and wear a nice watch. If he didn't have all of that, then I feel like he would have lost his kids. You know, I feel like as far as a parent goes, the only thing that he had going for him was that he could provide.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else he never had. Supposed to some parents, unfortunately, lose their kids now for a failure to provide, but they give them more love and affection than a lot of other parents. But he pushed away a lot of social workers and the, you know, the therapy offer. I feel part of it was embarrassment and not, he never believed in mental health as such. I feel like that was part of it. The other part was him being stubborn of, I want to live my life. Mm-hmm. And I don't doubt that he was investigated. I know that he was investigated. They found that he had nothing to do officially with my mum's death. They found that he could provide his parent. But I feel like if he didn't have the money that he had, and the solicitors that he had, so the lawyers that he had, I feel like he would have struggled to hang on to his kids, which I don't know if it would be for the better or the worse, because I don't know where that ends up putting me. But the only positive takeaway I can take away from him not being probed into that much, even though I've been miserable at some points in the years since. You know, and I probably have other issues that are actually just down to him. I feel like the good positive I can take away is I am where I am now. If I did it differently, would I be in the same place? No, 100% not. 100% not. So I can look at where I am now and go, it's not too bad. You know, life is, by all intents and purposes, okay, which, you know, for a lot of people, that's the best you can do a lot of the time. But no, that's the positive that I can take away from it of, well, everything worked out in the end.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that you could never talk about the situation with your dad. Did you ever try to, or you just didn't attempt to because he lacked that nurture and you knew you weren't going to get the response that you needed in that time?
It was so at first I would try and talk to him because I had a lot of questions. You know, when Daniel was first arrested, I wasn't told that he was arrested. I was told that he was on holiday with a friend, and part of me got suspicious of, that's strange. My main suspicion was, I remember saying to my aunt, that's weird, I didn't think Daniel had friends. That was my first suspicion, which is genuine. Wow. But aside from that, it was, you know, I try and talk to him at first. Now, I remember when my aunt was first allowed to see me again. Like one of the first times I went to go see her and my granddad and my nan, I went to go see them. And when it got time for me getting out the car back at my dad's house, I was just crying. I went, I don't want to go back. So my auntie took me to the front door because if it was up to her, she wouldn't have taken me. But when she's being watched by a social worker and the police will take up a kidnapping, because that's what it would be, she has no choice. So she's taken me to the front door when my then stepmom at the time answered. And she's always said, my stepmom's response to that was, don't do that, you know it'll make your dad angry. Mm. Not upset. Not upset. If she said upset, it's different, you know.
It is.
Because as a parent, I would be upset if my son felt that way. Mm-hmm. But he would be angry at me, which is how it was for a long time. He'd be angry if I ever mentioned anything to him. But I remember the day, it must have been a couple months after it happened, that I found out officially it was Daniel. Even though I may have had my suspicions, I found out officially he was the one that killed her. We were driving down a piece of road not far from our house. I can tell you the exact spot on the road where it was. And the conversation went as I went, when's Daniel coming back? And he said, Daniel's not coming back, he killed your mom. That was the end of the conversation. You know, he wouldn't engage any further. I didn't even cry because I knew if I cried in front of him, he'd probably get annoyed at me, which is no way to be. And it was difficult. It was difficult. And then over the years, as I got to maybe 15, 16, he would allow me to mention my mum in some ways, where it would be, you know, maybe I had a question about something to do when they were married, or, oh, when did you meet my mum? That kind of question, because when I was that young, you don't learn that things about your parents when you're that young. And eventually got a bit more open about mentioning that kind of thing. Like I asked him about the divorce, and he's always said he's been divorced multiple times now but he's been divorced since he went. It's about the best divorce that anyone that I know or myself has ever had. We sat down at the table, said, it's not working. You get this, I get this. And within a day, we divvied it all up. We didn't need solicitors. We didn't need anything like that. He kind of got a bit more open as time went on. But when it came to Daniel, his discussion would be very limited. And I knew that he was always having a relationship with her. I could tell when Daniel wrote a letter when it came through the postbox. But, you know, it was almost a thing of there's not much I can do with my dad, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I feel like he's stuck in his ways, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really speak to him anymore. You know, I speak to him very very limited amount. You know, I spoke to him on Christmas Day, maybe I sent him a text message. I'm not even sure if he replied. But, you know, it's part of that. Flaw probably came from, I feel a lot of his flaws came from worry about me, of he didn't want me to turn out like Daniel. And I feel he felt some form of shame for what happened. I feel like he does feel partially responsible. But at the same time, it wasn't any excuse for him making my life in a lot of ways miserable, and I never got the help I needed.
Absolutely.
Like I always said for the past few years that I've never been able to grieve over my mum, at least until very recently. I haven't, or until maybe a couple of years ago when I left his house. You know, I was never able to grieve over my mum. Which, you know, is disappointing. You need that to have some closure almost. Like, the way I see it, grief is a hole that's a really big, deep hole at first, really big and wide, and it's everywhere. So you're going to fall into it a lot. And the idea is when you grieve over someone, that hole gets smaller and smaller. So eventually you're not going to fall down it. But because I spent so many years not being able to talk about anything, not being able to do that, it stayed wide open. So it was very easy for me to fall down. And my big issue always was that if I was having a rough day and I felt a certain way or something set me off, you know, fire can still set me off. Big groups of people, big crowds, sirens can set me off without me realizing sometimes. But if I had an experience like that when I was 11, I went away with school and it was like 3 nights away. We called it a residential. And one night there was a campfire and a bit of ash got in my eye. And that kind of, that sent my brain going off. I didn't cause a scene. I didn't like cry or anything. But the teacher noticed, looked at me, and I was almost like blankly zoned out. And I was back in that moment of that night.
Wow.
And when she mentioned that to my dad to go, I just want to make sure he's okay, his response was, well, why you let him like that? You know, he was disappointed in me. He was angry at me, supposed to being like, oh, let's see what help we can get you. Which is, you know, another reason of now why I've chosen to speak out, because it's more of a thing of now I'm in a position where I'm old enough and hopefully into the new year I can hopefully be a beacon of positivity for people that have been through anything, however similar it may be, that there is a hope. And, you know, it'd be lovely one day to be able to sit down and have a group of people and be like, we go out and we make sure that people are okay after things like that, you know? Because unfortunately, whether it be police, whether it be councils in the UK or whatever you guys have over in the States, a lot of the time they are failing people. They aren't checking in when they're supposed to be. And it can lead to people going down a dark path, you know? If I was unlucky and I carried on down a dark path, which everybody thought that I was going to go down, you know, I was written off, oh, he's going to go down that dark path, then, you know, who knows where I could be. But if hopefully I'm coming forward now and even going into the future, I can be able to help people get the support they need, whether it be actual therapy, help them get in touch with people for that, or whether it be actually just someone to talk to through that's been through the same thing. You know, sometimes that's all that matters. I've always had friends in recent years. I've had a few friends lose their mum, you know, earlier. But, you know, it's they were maybe in their 60s when they died. And it's a bit of a, well, you don't expect that. And they asked me how I dealt with it. And I thought, well, maybe I can help. Because, you know, the one thing that everyone would always say to me would always be, yeah, I know my mum's died, but let's be honest, yours is far worse. So if you can get through it, I can get through it. And I know it's different for everybody, but I'm a big believer in that. If anyone can get through anything, it doesn't matter. Like, you can always push through it, no matter how big. You know, some things may be more difficult than others, but it still requires you to try and get past. Which I really hope now that I can, you know, eventually have a platform to be able to help people with that.
Wow. And what does that look like for you? Like, what platform would, see, I guess what comes to my mind and we discussed yesterday is you have a great idea for a nonprofit that is a support group, obviously, and that can get volunteers, people that, you know, I guess I think about it like this. When I enter my classroom, I try to be the teacher that I needed in school. And for your situation, you can see it in a same similar light. What did I need growing up that I can now offer to people that have suffered a similar tragedy? And not even in the same manner, but just a tragedy in general. that would be some, I mean, what does that look like for you? Do you want to start a nonprofit or social media?
Yeah, at some point, I feel like it would be a mix of everything because that's what everything is now, though. And, you know, if it was a nonprofit, it would have to have some form of social connection to it. Otherwise, you don't get word out. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm lucky enough that I'm of the age of social media. I know how it all works. Mm-hmm. And if I could use that to be able to reach out to people, even for conversations like this, you know, it's a position of, it'd be a good place for someone to be able to go talk to that have been through something like this, to be able to talk in front of people like I am today and say, it's worked out all right, or say where it didn't go right and how it's okay now or anything. You know, when earlier you said about being a statistic, and when we spoke about that yesterday, I always say the statistics wrong. You know, the amount of people that have something happen to them and end up going into a good place is far, far, far more than those that go into a bad place. The only reason that the statistic will ever show otherwise is I've never had anyone up until now ask me, what happened? Where are you? You know, now I'm saying I'm in a good place. But up until then, they'd probably just mark me down as a write-off. Yeah, he's probably going to get arrested for this or that or the other. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to end up in jail as well, which, you know, so far, not so much. You know?
Yeah.
The worst of that is a speeding ticket. But aside from that, you know, I find the statistic is, yeah, the statistic is wrong in a lot of ways. And I feel like it's a way of putting people down. You know, because I would see statistics of everything. You know, I would, after it happened over the years, I'd see that I'd be 5, 10, 20 times more likely to be arrested for murder than anybody else around me. Mm-hmm. But I know I'm not a killer and I would never do that. It's the thing of the only people that they follow up with are the people that end up going away for whether it be crime or a lot of people can spiral into other addictions, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. You know, if I wasn't so young, if I was the age I am now, I'd probably spiral into an addiction of some sort, but you need someone to pull you out. So eventually I'd love to be in a place where I could find similar people that have been through something similar to me and essentially just be a beacon of hope of, okay, you're going to be okay. Look, we're okay. We're nothing what they're telling you that you're going to be. You know, it's going to suck. It is. You know, there's no way around that. You can't magically heal it. It could get better. It could get worse before it gets better. But eventually it's going to get better. So that's the main thing that I would want to not encompass conversation or what I hope to do going into next year.
Wow. And I really love that because here on Teachers Talk Crime, we always try to bring light at the end of our episodes when we can. And we didn't have one for your brother's story because, I mean, we didn't get a chance to speak to you. You know, like we had no idea this was even going to happen. So now we have this whole episode dedicated to like, this really bad thing happened to my family, happened to me, and here I am on the other side of it. And, you know, like you said, sometimes are not going to be great. But overall...
I'm in a good place. You know, that's the main thing. And it's not to say that every day is going to be wonderful forever. It isn't.
Right,
I always find that nobody's life is like that. You could be the richest man in the world. You could be allegedly the happiest man in the world. You're always going to be disappointed or upset or angry at something. You know, that's life. I feel like a lot of people that are put into a situation like I am, for a long time, whenever something more would happen, I would see it as, oh, well, it's only getting worse as what happened before. Whereas a big thing that helped me was almost separating the things of, okay, that's happened, we're working through that. Okay, something else has happened here, let's work through that as well, separately though, as opposed to piling it all together and all of a sudden it's overflowing. You know, a big thing now is if something was to happen to me now, like middle of this year, one of my grandparents, or my last grandparent passed away from my dad's side of the family. But instead of how that used to affect me of someone else has died and panicking, it's now a thing of, that sucks, I'm going to be upset for a little while. But, you know, it's a separate thing and I don't want that to define what happened before. I feel like that's the best way of dealing with it, because otherwise you're always going to be tacking on to the grief before, and then I'll still be grieving over before forever. And if something else happens, it's just going to overflow, and then that's when you end up being the statistic.
Yeah.
Well,
you end up being negative, and then what happens is your friends don't want to be around negative people, and your family doesn't want to be around negative people, and instead, like you said, okay, I'm going to be sad, I'm going to allow this time to grieve, and then we're going to move on with life. You can still miss these people, and you always miss these people. But like you said, the hole gets smaller and smaller, and you still can find the great thing about what you have learned is that you are able to still see the good in days. Like, You can still see the positives in each day. You know, like you told us yesterday, you have a great job. Your aunt is such a strong hold in your life. You have great friends. You are very well traveled, and that is more than most people can say.
And that's a big takeaway.
You have found those big positives from tragedy. You know, if you spend the entire time looking at the negatives, you're always going to be negative, aren't you? And it's a massive spiral because before you know it, you do lose people. Like, I've had in my darkest hours, I've been a very negative person. You know, even in more recent years, I've been a negative person in some ways. You know, you can't ever fully prevent yourself from being that, but it's the idea of trying not to be, and eventually you won't be. You know, I've lost friends, I've lost relationships even over being too negative of a person sometimes, where something else has tipped me over. But I find now I'm not very often as negative as a person. I'll always be negative in some way, as everyone is, but I'd say 80 to 90% of the time I'm as positive as most people are. So that's the big thing for me. It's always trying to find the good in everything, and especially because, you know, a big thing that I've always said to myself is, well, it's great having good times, but unless I had bad times as well, and I've had some pretty bad times, then good times are just normal and you don't feel anything. It's nice to be able to see a difference of that really sucked, but then that means that that was so much better. And that was a big thing for me of, okay, things are going to suck, but things are also going to be that much better because you dealt with that. You know, it's almost the reward, if you will, for getting through that is you get the good times afterwards.
Yeah. I think that your mother would be very proud of you. I really do. I truly believe that. I can see from the way you've described her, what you don't realize, and I don't know if people have told you, is what you've described is the person that we've met in these last 2 days. Like, when we got off the phone with you, me and Ashley were like, he is the coolest person ever. Like,
we really were.
We really were. We were like, he is so easy to talk to. And I think that the person that you've described to us about your mom, you have those qualities that we're seeing as strangers, essentially. And I think that you are doing an amazing job at being a human.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, it's a big reason why I spoke to you guys specifically. As I was saying to you yesterday, I feel very comfortable speaking with you after listening to everything that I've heard about everything. I felt that you guys are the most honest, open, and genuinely caring about what you're speaking about. You know, you're very respectful to the victims, even sometimes the perpetrators. You still give them the respect, which I really appreciated. So I thought, you know, out of all the people it could go to, you guys were best suited because I feel comfortable being able to speak to you.
Thank you. We do try.
Thank you.
We try.
So we talked about your nonprofit that you want to start in the future. What else is in the future for you, Dom? Like, what else do you want to do?
I'm not sure, to be honest, yet. I'm luckily still young enough where I'm still finding my way in the world a little bit, deciding exactly where I want to go and what I want to do. But you know, in the past few months, I've, or not even months, but I'd say the past couple of years, a big thing that I've wanted to do has been, okay, how can I use what I've had to go through to help someone? So if that means, you know, whether it be the nonprofit or even just being able to have conversations like these so someone can hear it, that's a big thing of what I'm going to be doing going forward.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And are you okay with people contacting you via social media, as that is an easy way worldwide for people to get in contact?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Even over the years where I haven't already spoken out, I had people reach out. You know, not very many, because it wasn't the easiest thing to find. Yeah. To be honest, I had my profiles private for a while to avoid some grief. But now, if anybody wanted to reach out to me, you know, just send me a message and say, you know, whether it's a question you have for me unrelated to something you're going through, I will answer it. I don't mind. Or if it's a question that you have for something that you're going through and you think that I may understand, I may not understand, but I can try and help. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing. You know, I'm not going to be perfect, because nobody is.
Yeah.
But I'm always going to try and say what I dealt with and try and find a way that that can help you. Mm-hmm. So if you want to reach out to me, feel free.
Do you have any travel plans coming up?
Officially, no. not as of yet. But, you know, maybe in the coming months, I'll head out to anywhere. Who knows?
Yeah.
Last time I went abroad, I just hopped on a random flight last minute. So
I think that's the coolest thing about your culture in the UK, is that's something we don't see a lot in America. And like I said, I think that alone, that you are so well-traveled, is going to speak volumes to people here in the States, because that's not something we actually encourage here. And I don't understand why. And my friends in the UK are always scanning their passports and go in places. And that's something that we envy, and we should be. I think your travel experience too has really helped shape and make you grow as a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. You see a lot of different cultures. You see a lot of different ways of thinking. And it can just give you a more balanced look on things. Like I said before, I'm not religious, but you know, different parts of different ideologies and beliefs, you can always take something from it, go, that is going to help you in that way. And I'm just a big believer in almost karma as such. If you do good things happen to you.
Absolutely.
And if you're a good person, whether there's a heaven or there's not a heaven or whatever it may be, you're going to be on the best path for not only the life you're living now, but if you ever live again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This has been so awesome. Ashley, do you have anything else?
I don't have any other questions. This was a really great conversation.
It was.
Yeah. I've enjoyed my time.
Yes.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it as well. It's been nice to speak to you.
Yes. The last 2 days have been like, we've just been on this little like, high, like you're just so easy to talk to. You're such a cool person. When we got off the wheel, you realize we're 10 years older than him, and we just don't feel we're so much older than you.
you make it sound like I'm really young.
You, in comparison to
the comparison to a 34-year-old, yes.
Well, 10 years, that's 15 years now. 15.
Well, we don't have to do the math, Dom. We don't
know.
You
know,
yeah.
Just we're older.
We're older.
We're a little bit more seasoned.
Yeah, that's the best way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's awesome, though. We were just like, you know, we're really, again, we are very honored that you chose us. And we really hope that your story gets out there, and it will, because, you know, people are fascinated with this stuff, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. People really have this morbid curiosity about them.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. I have that curiosity about me, you know. I was saying to you yesterday, sometimes I'd be watching documentaries and things, and I'd look and I'd see the next one on's about my brother, and I'd be like, yeah, sometimes I forget that. You know, there's documentaries about what happened there as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't blame people for being interested. So I think it's a good thing to also know, you know, because people can take away that, okay, maybe this is a bad idea and that can put someone down a certain path in some ways. You know, there may be some kind of silver lining to find.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just good for everyone to be knowledgeable about anything that they want to be, as long as it's not being disrespectful or anything like that, which I've been through everything that you guys have done, and everything that you do is with the utmost respect, which is what I value most in the world, is respect.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, you have our respect. You have an amazing story. And Teachers Talk Crime is here to support you through any of your ventures. Yeah. You want to come to the States and you have a speaking gig, let us know.
We will show up.
We are happy to support you. We really want to see this thing get off the ground for you, because you genuinely can make an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the hope, really. To me, it's never mattered if 5 people listen to what I say and take something away from it, or 5 million take something away from it. If someone takes something away from what I say and can find it positive, then that's a victory in itself. You know, there's nothing more you can do. If someone's going to improve either their life or their mental state or anything in any kind of way, and you've helped that, I feel like that's a massive, massive victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we are gonna go ahead and sign off our usual way. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you, Dom, for being here. Mm-hmm. As always.
So as always, the bell don't dismiss you.
We do.
So we'll see y'all next time. Bye.
Bye.
Say bye, Dom.
Bye.